Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
We just are so pleased that you've been with us throughout the day, and I just want to thank you very much because it's just been a robust conversation, and it's a great kickoff for the California Council for the Humanities in our search for democracy. So thank you.
And I thank you all for joining us, and welcome to the closing plenary session of the California Council for the Humanities Forum on Democracy and the Culture of Civic Conversation. This session will discuss democracy and discourse in the 21st century, a century which in the first 11 years has proven to be quite a tumultuous one. We're living in a world in great flux. People all over the globe are clamoring and dying for democracy. And we here, after more than two centuries of self-governance, are still clamoring and fighting and trying to fashion and define our democracy because it's vital and it's never finished and it's always a work in progress. But it's certainly changing faster these days. With so many sources and streams of information coming at us, it's easier to be informed now than ever before, but it's also easier to be confused and overwhelmed. And what we hope with this panel is not to overwhelm or confuse, but to inform. We are going to have some questions and answers at the end of the session, and we are being joined by people who are watching us on the web. So thank you all, and thank you, panelists.
Thank you.
I would like to start with Omnia, if I could. We've all been watching the revolution in Egypt. It has shaken up the world, and it has shaken up our, and by our, I mean the United States and the West's view of the region and of the people and the attitudes towards the people. Egypt is now having a loud and vibrant and vital dialogue about democracy between the protesters, the students, the military, you name it. And right now it's unclear where that dialogue is going. It's not necessarily the end result is going to be democracy. I was just wondering, from your research and your contacts and your instincts, where do you see things going?
Well, I think it can go in a number of different directions, but I think that what we've seen so far has been an amazing grassroots movement. Basically, I mean, it's almost inaccurate to call it a singular movement because it's basically been an amazingly complex historical assemblage of multiple forces, some of which are contradictory, but all of which have seemed to cohere in asking for the removal of Mubarak, which they sort of attained in a very spectacular fashion, and the removal of the emergency laws, which has not yet happened. Many have called for an entirely new constitution, and what's on the table right now is merely constitutional amendments, in addition to numerous other claims for social justice and social welfare, and an end to police brutality. And so I think we shouldn't lose sight. I'm fairly optimistic. I think that the people have come so far and that they've realized their own power in their ability to topple a regime that has ruled, more or less with an iron fist since 1981. And I think once this recognition of the political power of the demographic masses, that there's no turning back and that they won't settle for less. So even though, in fact, there are counter-revolutionary movements on the ground and people who are trying to stave back the type of progress that has already been made, that people just won't settle for less. And so every Friday, there's constantly a continuous call for what people are calling a millionaya, million plus people in Tahrir Square and elsewhere, all over not just Cairo, but all over Egypt. So I think I remain optimistic that, and then just most recently with the resignation of Ahmed Shafiq, every single step, every single kind of buckling of the old system, which was in fact, that was all the chants from Tahrir, where the people want to topple the regime. The people want to topple the system is a more accurate way to translate. And they're doing it bit by bit, and they know it'll take time, and the road is long yet, but I think we should be optimistic.
We spoke on the phone very briefly, but we were talking about, you know, we're watching this unfold on our TV screens, and clearly there was an eruption of years of anger and frustration, but there seemed to be an eruption of another sort, especially with the youth, and that was the use of social networks. Can you tell us how significant, or if such things as Facebook and Twitter were significant in this revolution?
Well, I think it's funny because for initially, I think, and I think partly this says something about our access to information about the region, there was a moment in which the Western media really faltered in explaining, talking about, describing, understanding this revolution. And I think the best way in which to think of it as a new social media revolution is that it was a new social media revolution for us here in the U.S. and in the West, and that there was a way in which, for example, for myself, I was able to follow minute by minute. I mean, everything was moving so quickly. You couldn't rely on evening news. You needed to have, I mean, no offense, I watched that as well to sort of end the day, but you needed to have a minute by minute, blow by blow account, and things, especially when things were so tenuous, you know, during the time of the terror and so forth, to know exactly what was unfolding. So I feel it was very much a new social media kind of revolution in the way that we experienced it. But in terms of people on the ground in Egypt, surely, of course, there were lots of different groups, like the We Are All Khaled Said group, even the April 6th movement, that do have new social media outlets, and they were important. But a lot of long-standing grassroots movements, and mainly the labor movements, which have been so active in Egypt in the past decade, tremendously active in terms of nationwide sit-ins, strikes, and Egypt has a long history of that, going all the way back to 1919 in terms of labor movements and social organizing. That, in addition with other new social movements that had been formed in response to specific police brutality cases, and that was also significant. NGOs and other social organizations have all been active. And last but not least, spontaneity, a tremendous amount of spontaneity, that I think that was one of the most amazing things that we saw in what was happening.
Well, Professor Chris, if I might.
I was looking for the professor.
In the early days of the Egyptian Revolution, protesters faced down police batons and bullets and thugs on horseback and camelback, yet they never backed down. And in Libya now, we see the protesters facing bullets and even strafing by jets. You were imprisoned in Nigeria as a political prisoner, not once, but three times, I believe, and we're even on death row, if that's not correct. As we look around the world, we see that suffering under oppression is a common human condition. So what is it about oppression, or let me rephrase that, what was it for you? What was the break for you and the other young people in Nigeria to say, enough, this is worth dying for?
Well, before I do that, only because I'm a writer, and so I've had a long-standing quarrel with language, I am worried about the term revolution, as particularly as it applies to what's going on in the Middle East right now. Because a revolution implies not necessarily singular, but a largely unified, organized ideology behind this. So in China, in Russia in the early days. So what you have is an uprising. It's a revolt. And this is what we had in Nigeria, many, many revolts. And these are wonderful things, and I'm really, really glad to hear that sort of the revolution is on, and at the grassroots level, this is sort of being questioned and interrogated continuously so that we don't fall into, because the danger of that, and this is what's happened subsequently in other parts of Africa, is that we have these big uprisings, these wonderful so-called revolutions, but there's no guiding ideology behind it. And so then it makes it easier for Western influence to come into those countries, particularly American interests, and find a group they feel is most aligned to them and use them to pressure a direction that is not really what is reflective of what's really on the grassroots. So I am so full of hope and so amazed at what's happening right now, but I'm also slightly terrified about the subsequent outcome, because I think we've moved too quickly from questioning to celebration. And there's always a danger. I mean, I don't mean in Egypt, because mm-hmm. when you're in a revolution, when you're facing down bullets, there's no celebration going on. But I think we tend to do that in the West. We tend to try to ennoble things and ennoble people. So that, I just wanted to point that out. Nigeria, in my case, the thing about when you come from a country like Nigeria, there are multiple uprisings and multiple revolts over years, but because we haven't threatened to take our oil away from the West, no one really pays attention to us. So, but I think the real, if you really want to trace the roots of what sort of finally burst out in the 80s, because the 80s in Nigeria was a real confrontation, starts way back in 1922 when Igbo women, it was the women, had what was called the Aba Women's Tax Riot, where they basically, a bunch of traders routed British soldiers, women, who tried to depose the local British commissioner who was taxing them too highly. And of course, this is also what happens with a lot of uprisings, is that they're heavily, mostly gender biased towards women, and then we men always arrive at the, you know, in time for the cameras. So that's also, I would like to sort of, I wondered if that's what's happening in Egypt too, where we often become the spokespeople for things we didn't start. But by the time I was, you know, for me, my individual journey was much more bizarre within that. But I think my generation had come through a civil war. We had either been boy soldiers in the war, or some of us had not been subject to that, or had, were like three or four during the war, but we were all living in this kind of post-war trauma. And the level of ethnic divisions was so rampant. We were being raised to hate each other. Just directly, then the narrative was to hate each other's ethnicity. And I think it got to the point, when you couple that with 35 years of a military dictatorship, and even though there were successive regimes, it was one singular dictatorship, and this kind of abuse of power, it was the students, usually, and I think in almost every country, Ethiopia, everywhere, it's always the students and the market women who start these revolutions. And so students suddenly started to organize themselves, as young as high school students, 15, 16-year-olds. And for the first time, because it was students and we were spread across the country, we were all organized around this idea. And so that was really the tipping point, because the petty hatreds we had for each other started to disappear in the face of this. But I think there's something really remarkable about the human spirit. And I know that in America we see this all the time, because this is not an unrepressive country, that you can only hold people down for so long, and the threat of death is not as frightening as a life under servitude, right? And the thing is, if you are in a group of people marching and people are strafing you with bullets and the people in front of you are dying, it's impossible for you in that moment to break and run. It's just not... it's not the human response. It's a really interesting thing, and almost tribal mind sets in, which is a beautiful thing. But in every country, it's different. But I think always it's young people and women who, in most of the African countries at least, tend to be the most marginalized group, the groups without voices, who begin to articulate those voices for themselves. And they're also groups that are used to grassroots organizing. In Nigeria, almost all the labor unions are women-led. Right, the nurses, even the labor. So I think that there's a mix of that. But, you know, I don't know. You know, it gets to a point where people can only take so much. Hmm. And we will stop taking it, regardless of the threat of death. And I think after Tunisia, Egypt, the people in Egypt sort of felt emboldened. And after Egypt, I think people in Libya finally felt emboldened. Because Libya has been behind half of the wars and genocide in West Africa, at least. And so, you know, our friend Mr. Gaddafi. So I think that people had, you know... And part of what happens, you know, we think we know the Middle East, but we don't know really. I grew up in Africa. I grew up in Nigeria. But I don't really know what it's like for an everyday person living in Libya. Right, so I think that it sometimes is difficult on the outside to speculate what can set off a group of people in a different country. The reasons are so complicated, but I think it's that ultimate human moment where you realize that it's untenable to go on living the way you are, because in a way it is a death. And so at least this way there is a chance that you can change things. Of course, death in Africa is a difficult thing, because the West often only responds when people start to get shot in these situations. And so oftentimes during civil wars, people have done terrible things to get Western attention. So we know, like in Sierra Leone during the war, that the hacking off of limbs was an organized campaign by the rebels to get the Western powers to step in and stop the war. And so violence is a complicated thing. Uprisings are complicated. But as someone who was lucky to survive one, I can understand the impetus to do it. And I think you find that, I mean, of course, it was less violent here, but it still were costs, even with what we saw happen with young people organizing largely during Obama's time. You know, I had students who didn't have money or were sort of regularly deducting money from their PayPal accounts into his campaign. And so at every level, and because I don't really like to get into this idea of hierarchies of pain and hierarchies of cost, I think at every level people have paid for things in a certain way. But the democracy is not a natural state for human beings, and it's a state of evolution. It's actually what makes us human, whatever form that democracy takes. Because our natural state as humans is a little more aggressive. You know, we tend to eliminate or annihilate the people we don't agree with, and so it's important that we have democracy. Simply because it's a language of that will sustain evolution of the species, if nothing else. If we can't believe in it idealistically, we should at least believe in it practically.
Yeah. What I hear you both saying, though, is that you're optimistic seeing what's going on, but that democracy is not necessarily the outcome.
Well, I wrote it down and attributed it to you. You seem to be saying that democracy is an unfinished project. Yes. And I think that is perhaps the best lesson that we can take, that it's something that's in process and that requires the application of human labor and also human creativity. And so I might disagree a little bit in terms of with Chris in terms of the question of sort of revolution versus uprising, not so much in the desire to uniformly categorize what happened in Egypt as a revolution per se, but simply to point out that perhaps we've been constrained by our own imagination or the lack of a particular type of political imagination that kind of forces us to always look to the historical past for analogies and possibilities of repetition. And that if we could just creatively visualize what might be possible, what kinds of historical roads might be taken moving forward that aren't indicated by the French Revolution or any other kind of examples, you know, of other revolutions or revolutions that were in process and then that succumbed to counter-revolutionary forces, that then perhaps we might also be, that might give us cause to be more optimistic.
Hmm. Well, Jane, we Americans know that democracy is a messy business. It can be loud, it can be frustrating, and we hear people in Tahrir Square saying we want democracy almost as though it's a magical incantation. It's a panacea. Are we expecting too much?
Well, I'm afraid that I have nothing to say compared to what you two have just said. It's very remarkable, and I feel very inept at this point to provide any additional commentary here, but let me try. And I wanted to make three points, and let me pick up on one that is motivated out of something you just said, Chris, which with respect to, you said something like it's hard to hold it down for too long, and by that meaning an uprising or a sense that things are not right. And that's true in the United States, too, to different degrees, right? I mean, there's repression, as you noted, in the United States. There's plenty of inequality, and there's also a lot of good things. But going back to the initial point that democracy itself is this unfinished business, it's like your house being constantly under renovation. For those of you who have gone through one, you'll know that it's never perfect, and you just keep trying. Sometimes you need an architect. Sometimes you try to do it yourself. But I wanted to make three points. One is about education that I want to start with. The second one is about how we even think about what engagement is. When we see protests in the streets and mass killings and disruptions. We often think about engagement as being something that we get up off our chairs and do. I want to us to problematize that. And the last thing I want to discuss was the notion of representation and the distinctions that we make within democracy about whether it's direct versus representative or some other form. And to hope to bring us back to some of the conversations we had earlier this morning in the first plenary. But let me pick up on this question of it's hard to hold it down for so long. It's also hard to keep democracy going for so long when even in particular, and I'll just keep my comments to the United States with respect to the degree and level of repression and unfairness in the United States. We are much better off as democratic citizens than people throughout most of the rest of the world, and we are often remiss to state that. We're clearly better off in many ways. Not all of us, and to varying degrees, but we are. Having said that, we persist in a system of government and a society and politics, as well as economy, of vast inequalities that continue to grow. And this is what I want to raise with respect to education. We've, throughout the day today, have spoken a lot about the role of students and the role of education, and it being in many ways not a panacea, but certainly something that's always good for democracy. And clearly that's not the case. So what I'd like you to do is at least consider the possibility that part of the way we hold it down, that democracy in the United States holds it down, is through education. On the one hand, education is this great device by which we are to see other cultures, understand our history, imagine new things. And yet at the same time, education in the United States, whether it's unequal systems of delivery of public education, or for that matter, even higher education, to which we are all complicit in, one of the things that we do in teaching students, you get an A, and you get an F. There's all you kids over here who got the A or who got into UCLA or Stanford or USC, all the schools that, and Riverside and Davis as well. The point being, you are the ones that deserve it.
So, nice representation.
But the point is that we engage in democracy. We have a political system based in a principle of equality, but an economic and an educational system, one that reinforces inequality and provides an ideology of meritocracy that says you deserve it if you ended up on the right tail of the distribution because you're smart, and you deserve to be in that BMW and that big house and wherever you are, and you people over here, you don't deserve it because you're not very smart and you didn't make it through the system, and it's kind of your fault. Yeah. So on the one hand, education is this great device, right? It is the students that have propelled democratic movements and forward thinking. At the same time, in the cooked democracy, as Joyce was making the distinction this morning between raw and cooked vegetables, in the cooked democracy, education itself can be a very potent socializer that allows people to believe in a meritocracy and can allow a supposedly equal political system get layered over an economic system that is built on inequality, that is built on a distribution wherein we teach them it's okay for you over here on the right tail, you made it, you were smart, and you deserve it. I think that in some respects, what we do is as we educate, we need to be very mindful, and many of you in here are educators, of the extent to which what we do is help to develop a false consciousness, and among our students that this is all right to do. I think we need to re-examine that, at least think carefully about that. The second thing is with respect to engagement. Most of what we've talked about and what we've thought about are the things that we do. We get up off the chair, we get in the street, we protest. But sometimes, and in many ways, Americans don't often do this. It's very rare that we get up and do this. It's even rare that we vote. Half the people in the United States and about 40% in California who are registered to vote don't come out. Right. And one has to ask not only why for a simple act as voting it is this way, but what the meaning of sitting out means. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean that people are too lazy or they're ill-informed. They might be. It also might be the case that they voice their dissent and their disapproval by not doing something. So in many ways, as we were just discussing before, if you are powerless and you acting means you get your head chopped off. Not acting, and not acting in particular ways, is your only source of power. Mm-hmm. So imagine you're having a fight with your significant other and you're losing badly and you know it. Mm-hmm. You decide you're just not going to say anything. You're going to give them the silent treatment, and that is your power. Now, I'm not saying that that's how we ought to think about engagement, but I think what we ought to do is consider what we mean when we say engagement, mm-hmm. and what the purpose of not engaging is. It's not clear that it's always a negative thing for democracy. It might in and of itself be its own statement. Mm-hmm. And finally, the last thing I wanted to talk about was this concept of representation. And it seems that there's a little bit of a disconnect as we've been talking about democracy, as if it were something where we all voted on everything, mm-hmm. where we all spoke on everything. In the United States, we very clearly, even in California, with all the initiatives and with all of the voter participation and policymaking, we live in a representative democracy. We cannot forget that. And at issue and at with respect to the alienation or with respect to where we might make repairs with the leaky roof or the wall that's falling down or the bathroom floor that has a hole in it, where we might consider making repairs is not only to citizens themselves, but to the representative institutions and the structures we have that purport to represent what individuals think. And it is quite important to remember that if we go back to the founders and we go back to the founding document of this nation, that representation, as it is understood in the federal context, is not just about voters and who voted. Representatives, at least in the United States House of Representatives and in other legislative districts such as the Senate, are based on the residents, the people there, not just the voters. And it's important for us, I think, to consider elements of democracy that are just beyond the direct individual side and consider also structures of representative government.
Well, you were talking about education and participation, and it is cynical but no less true that some politicians benefit from voters being ill-informed, that the most easily digested soundbite is often the one that prevails, while the issue that needs some complexity and discussion, we're either too overwhelmed or too confused and we don't have time for it. Does that frighten you? Does that represent a crisis in our democracy?
Well, I think it's always been this way. I'd like to hear what other people think. It's always been this way. I mean, when you're in power, the last thing you want to do is redistrict, right? You definitely don't want that, because you also, when you're in power, you don't want to bring new voters in. You don't want a voter mobilization in your district because it creates uncertainty. The past is the best indicator of the future, and if you keep the same people in your voting population, that's better for you. So nobody in power, the man doesn't want to give it up, right? He doesn't want to give up the structure of what is there because he's the man. And the minute that you alter that, that's what all protest movements are about. That's what all, you know, you're comfortable living in there. Even if there's a hole in the floor, you're comfortable with it. And the minute you start to mess with it, you have dust and noise and construction and all of these things that could disrupt your comfort. So it's not at all surprising that the status quo is favored by those who are already in power.
Anyone?
I think there are a couple of things. I think there's a way in which hierarchical notions of ability kind of permeate our discussions of democracy. And in the Egyptian context, I saw that really clearly because I had been asked to write some comments about it for a student newspaper. And, you know, I specifically said, like, please send me the article before you publish it. And that didn't happen. And my position ended up being juxtaposed to two individuals who basically said that democracy is not like a button that you push, and Egyptians aren't, in essence, capable of it because of high rates of illiteracy. And that was specifically the argument was posed in terms of the question of literacy. And, you know, I had, luckily, because, you know, a lot of this is online, I was able to post some comments, and, you know, I really wanted to push the individuals who had kind of tried to represent Egypt in terms of this kind of binary of literacy and illiteracy to rethink that by stating that one simply need no colloquial Egyptian Arabic to realize the complex poetry and prosody that was going on in the chants that were taking place in Tahrir and sort of the complex political reasoning that was taking place there. So I think that's I feel at times we underestimate people's abilities, and that also, and I certainly feel this as an American, that sometimes we're constrained by, again, our political imagination, our conceptualization of what constitutes politics, electoral politics, two-party system, so on and so forth. And as Jane pointed out, kind of taking non-participation as, or the lack of participation, as a clue, as an index of something perhaps more serious going on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you said that, so both of you. I like the idea when you bring up this notion of illiteracy, because it also brings up the notion of what democracy means. And, you know, there's a tendency to think that there is a democracy and that it's a universal concept, and not, but there's democracy in situation. And every country, Britain is very different from America. I mean, just in the fact that Britain has a third party, for instance. In America, you have a 19th century British model. Two parties essentially galvanized around capital, one slightly less aggressive than the other. And no viable third option. So, I mean, but we hold this up, you know. And if you were to look in a traditional African, just let's say, let me just speak about Nigeria, or even smaller still, the Igbo nation. Mm-hmm. The reason the British didn't take it seriously is we had no kingship systems. We had a basic system of democracy, social democracy, where things were deliberated at successive levels of representation based on age grades and based on gender. And at the top level, the oldest men and oldest women held council together and made final decisions. But also that when we talk about illiteracy, the average African, I would say this because I've been all over the continent, from Cairo to Cape Town, is way more politically engaged and educated than any American, even the most educated American. Nigerians don't consume literature that is not political. The newspapers are the biggest selling things. The newspapers in every language. The radio disseminates this information. People are over beer having... I mean, even when I was in Cairo, we would buy tea in the street corner. The guy selling you the tea will get engaged in this deconstruction of America that'll leave you breathless, you know. And you know, I remember at the time I had to do my PhD dissertation, I kept thinking, why am I writing on poetry? Because if I was writing on politics, I would just come here, record everything, rip it off, and write it. And you know, so that is something illiteracy. When we talk about illiteracy, what we really mean is someone can't read or write English, as though English is. And then my mother, who was English, often thought Americans didn't speak English. She always used to say, we gave Americans a language, why don't they use it? So, you know, these are something to think about. And also this idea of education, because like I said, democracy doesn't strike me in all my interactions in the world as something that we all default to. It's something we learn. It's something we're social. That's why we send kids to nursery school, to learn how not to punch each other, right? And so it's this whole idea that we feel like after 2 centuries of democracy in America that it's perfect, that we don't need to learn. We need to keep relearning. And if you have a conversation, there are so many Americans who are in tune that get... My wife got the ballots the other day, and we had sat down. We're trying to figure out who to vote for, what does it mean? I like this person, but then how am I participating? You know, it's hard enough when you have a PhD, much less when you don't. So, when we talk about education, there is also a need, not just in this meritocracy, which is America's biggest lie, because it's needed. We need it to hold up the myth of the country, but it's the idea that we don't. When we talk about education, we don't talk about disruption. This idea of multiple voices, constructive dissonance. So, for instance, Barack Obama is weak if he decides to negotiate with the Republican Party in a dialogue over how we should have a policy. Because the way we see it, if you're in power, you decide everything. Then the next guy comes along in a different party and undecides all that stuff, which is, of course, why I know trains get, you know. So I think that even in America, the idea of democracy is purported ideally as an idea of dialogue, but it isn't really a dialogue because... It's their reaffirmation of my belief system and their affirmation of your belief system. And so when it gets really messy, and you had a great analogy for the house, when all these construction noises begin, when you're getting all the dust in your coffee, people don't like that so much anymore. And then we resort to the politics we see now, and this idea that we can't talk to other people, that any kind of dialogue is weakness. And yet, but that's the whole basis of democracy. And it's really interesting you pointed out in Egypt this ongoing dialogue every day, this reinventing of the narrative of the revolution. Like we need to keep rediscussing this. So I agree with everything that's been said here.
We talk about this dialogue, and we all live here. We all read the papers and see the TV and the cable TV. And we see what passes for dialogue here. It's not so much dialogue as a verbal assault. And, you know, what passes for, it's like death panels and keep your hands off my Social Security. And it never goes much deeper. So how do we, in this mature democracy, solve the problems like health and Social Security and climate change, believe it or not, or any of these problems, if we can't even talk amongst ourselves in a serious manner?
Well, I mean, if you're asking us how to solve those, I think we'd all have TV shows if we knew the answers to all of them. You know, we'd be like Dr. Phil.
And
we'd
more.
Just be handing out aphorisms, you know.
Well, so. do we solve our problems if we can't speak to each other without screaming and shouting and pointing fingers?
Well, I mean, I think worldview is a really interesting thing, and this is why I was using the idea of language with the revolution, not so much because I'm making these historical comparisons, but because every time we use words, they're so loaded culturally, and we think they're not, but they are, and these loaded words are actually simulacrum that do enact themselves in the world. I give you just a simple instance. When I first moved to America, having been a former political prisoner, the people would talk about the process of healing, what the process of healing meant to me. And after a while, I began to realize that in America, healing is the erasure of trauma, the erasure of the memory of trauma, the pretense that trauma doesn't exist. Whereas for an African, healing is learning to deal and live with a damaged self that no longer inflicts damage. And so if you go to South Africa today, there are museums to apartheid all over the place that are full of all races of South Africans. There's this dialogue, there's this open conversation. It's not perfect. It's nowhere near perfect. But there are attempts to have a conversation from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission all the way that has not happened here. There's a Museum of Tolerance in L.A., but hardly anyone goes there. We don't, you know, if you bring up the civil rights, it's you're playing race cards, all these sort of ridiculous things. And so even at the level of culture and the preservation of culture, we have such a separate worldview. So until we can start to really accept that the worldview itself, which is, I think, what you're speaking about this education that we provide, that the worldview is faulty, that healing is not the erasure of difficulty, or that dialogue is not the erasure of problems, and that dialogue doesn't mean you agree with me in that wonderful way that we in Southern California make fun of the Northern Californians, where, you know, it's always so polite and everyone's representational, and here we think we're more edgy. But in the real sense... But in the real sense that at least... But in the real sense that that we are struggling, it is a struggle, it is a process. And every little shift is a huge shift. In a country like Nigeria that hadn't had serious democracy for over 30 years, we recently became democratic, maybe 13 years now. The most telling moment that everything had shifted mentally for me in the country was when our now deceased president was sick and had disappeared from sight for 68 days. Nobody even knew where he was. The vice president did not take power. The military did not initiate a coup. We waited for 68 days to have a conversation about where to go with Nigeria. That seems so insignificant, but that is a huge, huge step forward. And so I think that that's what when I speak about dialogue, that's really what I'm talking about, not to solve the problem, but to problematize the conversation and to keep saying this is way more nuanced than you want to have it. And sound bites are wonderful if you're a talk radio show host, but they really don't help the average American in their life.
We started off talking about North Africa and the Middle East, and we are the big kid on the block. How is it possible for us to, just a little background, you were talking about an educated electorate. I would dare say that before 9/11, there were few Americans who could point out Afghanistan or Iraq on the map.
That may still be the case.
I was just about to say that.
We've had a dramatic learning curve since then, but I still think that's probably the case. So how do we have this dialogue about democracy with the rest of the world when we don't really understand the rest of the world?
Well, I think partly, and this goes back to what everyone's been saying, is to sort of let go of the hubris of thinking that America has the perfect modular, universal form of democracy that should be exported to the rest of the world. And I think Iraq and Egypt function as sort of tragic counterpoints to each other in instructing us in those very difficult lessons. And so I think just acknowledging that there is something to be learned from watching events that happen elsewhere. And I have to say, I mean, watching events in Egypt unfold from here, from the U.S., it was really, it's been a profound opening. I've experienced it as in a way that 9/11, I think, functioned as both a closing of political discourse and an opening. And I see that with my students, the shift in terms of their desire to know, their desire to hear new narratives and to reshape their own narratives about what they think the Middle East region is. So I think we have a tremendous opportunity here. And it's been so visible in terms of, again, I keep going back to the way in which initially when events unfolded in Egypt, the media kind of faltered. So people were basically on autopilot. You know, they wanted to talk about certain things depending on where they stood on the political spectrum, whether it was Islamic fundamentalism or Western imperialism, and to fit in events into narrative molds, you know, by hook or by crook. And so I think there's been, you know, since then, there's been tremendous kind of malleability and new forms of media that have kind of presented more compelling narratives. And I think that's been heartening to see.
I mean, Americans export many things, like to take credit for many things, and democracy is one of them. I think it's a difficult task to expect leaders, people who would represent the United States in discussions about that, to be more self-critical. I think, you know, it's Americans themselves are love their government, may hate their president or their congressman, but in generally speaking, they're fans of democracy, most people are. And whether that's a question of that they have come to this falsely or if they believe it, the material conditions of most people are probably better in the United States and in Western democracies than anywhere else. It's not necessarily the case that they're free from repression in all areas, but the material conditions are much better. It's difficult to persuade a population that, you know, there's no bigger cheerleader for the USA than, you know, the American population. I think it would be difficult to move away from that. You know, the notion of educating the public about other societies runs the risk of in many ways, the simplification of very complex situations into much smaller nuggets that invite judgments about along the lines of, you know, a Huntingtonian version of how to divide up the world, and then we can simplify understanding it that way, which is not to say that we ought not attempt it. It is to say, however, that there are complications in doing so if that lesson is not one that is a deep lesson and one that requires some examination of oneself and one's own nation. It always... I wanted to ask what people thought. I meant to ask this morning and in the afternoon session, too. Just about, it was in the information session, political information. I mean, more people can routinely name, you know, the starting lineup of their baseball team, of their city, than the Supreme Court justices. Now, we know that people know very little, and in the information age is probably not that important. But I guess I wonder why Americans, like around a Super Bowl event, can tell you, many of them, not everybody, many Americans can tell you all the intricacies of this play and that guy's foot surgery and what he's drinking for lunch and how many carbohydrates he needs to eat a day and the whole game plan and all the intricacies, not only, let's just leave aside football, any other kind of sport, Americans are, and it is a spectator sport. It's not something that you don't see as many people going on actually playing football. And one has to wonder why and under what circumstances advanced industrialized democracies, because this is true elsewhere too, particularly in Western Europe, mm-hmm. where what you see are tremendously well-educated populations who live for the sport but not for politics. So what is it about? Is it about the political system? Is it about our human mind? Is it about our laziness that makes us intensely interested in Dancing with the Stars or the Super Bowl, and for the most part not that interested except very episodically in politics? I'm not sure that's something that can be answered. It just I just wonder, particularly given the comment that you made about the tea vendor, I think that's true in other places as well.
So we have all this information and we have the freedom to read about the debt crisis or Charlie Sheen, and
what
many of
think?
Us choose to read about Charlie Sheen.
I would like to read about Charlie Sheen.
Yeah. So I think we're getting to the point now where we wanted to open this up for questions. Is that, do we have any questions coming up from our viewers on the web, or can we just take some from here in the audience first? Yes, sir.
My name is Marcelo Miller, and I do international exhibits. I have an international art exhibit agency. I take artists from different countries, bring them here, and then I take American in the diversity and take them to those other countries. And I've been to Korea, I've been everywhere, and you're right. There are a lot of people, especially in Korea and everywhere else, they know more about our culture, and they are very intelligent. And what I want to say to you is that I think for the 21st century America, you know, and we all understood it because Los Angeles is a nestle where we can be enriched with everybody that is from other countries here. I think that we need programs and all that to actually bring people from our basic American democracy mentality, which is not, you know, you talk about sports. Well, you go to college, you root behind the athletes, okay, that are not smart, but probably they got talent. And when you're in the arena, you got educated, and people that are not educated all rooting for something that brings everybody together, like a tribal understanding that we're one body. And Americans have done it with sports, done it with actors. They lose their alter ego to become one mess. But when you're doing international, you learn the power of their culture, and then you see the common ground. In fact, you know, when we did the riots, I was probably the first one to use that word common ground when I did the show that was called Masa in Channel 5, aired it, and I said LA has to find the common ground because they're all here. So I think as an educator that you guys are, the question is, because you guys are in that responsibility, especially if you come from other countries, and that's an enrichment, that I think that the 21st century, you know, we must get Americans to travel, to go somewhere outside of America, you know, so that they can really see, and especially children, you know, because that's what I do with artists. Thank you.
I'm not sure the people watching on the web are able to hear our audience members here speaking, and the gentleman was asking or was stating that often people in foreign countries know more about us than we know about them, and that Americans can come together over something like a sporting event, but not necessarily for politics, and was urging Americans to travel more and see the world more. And I don't think there'd be much disagreement with that on this panel. Yeah?
Although, because I know, I mean, I only say this because, you know, it's so sometimes it's very easy to get into this kind of very simple America bashing in that kind of kind of way. Let me just talk about Nigerians. Nigerians, temperamentally, you could think of them as the sort of the Manhattanites of Africa. They're the New Yorkers, you know. You know, when I first got to New York, I ordered a coffee, and the guy said, with or without? And I was like, with or without what? And he's like, back of the line. Like, you know, this is what Nigerians are like. We think we're the most civilized in the world, not just of Africa. And until, and so we know a lot about America and Western Europe because it's a power dynamic. We need that information in order for us to function, we feel, in a global world, in a global economy. So it's not entirely only motivated by interest. But up until it, when it was suddenly difficult for Nigerians to get visas, then we started moving into the rest of Africa, and then we actually started for the first time expanding our own awareness of our own continent. So I just always like to say that these are human problems, and they're not, I don't know if it serves to just make it an American problem, because then that suddenly puts this kind of onus to solve a problem that it doesn't really exist. I think it's a human question, and we need to address it more in that sort of sense, if that makes any sense at all.
But I guess I don't see that as America bashing as much as we were talking about this being a continuing dialogue. Mm. That's what we do. We hash it out. Well, we fight it out.
Right.
And if we don't bring these issues up to ourselves, right, then we will never be able to hash these things out. Right. So, you know, we sort of need to hold a mirror up to ourselves, right, and say, "Oh my God, I didn't know I looked like that."
Right. But in the process of doing that, I just don't want to romanticize other places. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all need to hold up mirrors.
We're all in the same boat.
Yes, I think essentially. Yeah. It's that Baldwin idea.
We have a question for Jane from Gail. And Gail is asking Jane, how do residents without the right to vote participate fully in democracy in America? Citizens do not view them as valid voices.
Well, I think the simple answer is they don't. They're not capable of participating fully. There are a couple things to note. One, in years past, and someone brought this up earlier in the nation, we allowed non-citizens to vote. And there are some localities, I believe, in Maryland and Berkeley, in other progressive parts of the United States that allow, I believe New York City had allowed in some boroughs, participation in school elections by non-citizens. But remember that democracy, when we think about democracy as very inclusive, it's only inclusive in as much as we have citizenship and immigration policies that account for that, right? So to the extent that democracies are, when we enforce citizenship policies, we're saying you get to belong and you don't. And that in and of itself, by creating boundaries in the nation state and creating citizenship policies, we are by definition excluding some and including others, privileging some and not others. And so the answer to the question is simply that they don't have the same rights. Having said that, there are plenty of other activities that people do that we didn't really talk about. We talked a lot about voting today, and we talked about things at the one end and the other end of the spectrum, voting and protesting. There's a lot of stuff in between that non-citizens can do and do to a high, to a degree that is, on the one hand, I think, very encouraging that people are involved in their communities, whether or not they have have been given the legal right to remain here as citizens.
Yes, please.
Could it be as simple as the fact that we've, in our cultural memory, have never had a military regime rule over us, that we've never been subject to a coup, that we've always, even when we rebelled against a tyrant, he was a tyrant who couldn't raise taxes without the consent of Parliament, so that our task isn't as immediate as your task would be to avoid that military rule over us, that our task is more to get people to understand how democracy and politics and voting and activism relates to their everyday life, as opposed to that if we don't use it, we'll lose it kind of mentality?
I don't know, but I will only point out that I would say that doesn't take into the discourse of memory, slavery, right? Because you're speaking about a particularly privileged group of Americans. So that's not representational of American memory. It's certainly, if you asked Native Americans, that they would have a completely different story to tell you. So this is always what I'm saying, that you have had these military regimes, and in many ways, you may still have. You've had genocides, right? And as of up until the Second World War, we had camps. So,
and we still,
right? We still do. Right? So I just wanted to throw that out there, just to say that there isn't a collective memory of America.
You might also want to think about how different this conversation might be if we were in Birmingham, Alabama, or somewhere in the South, where following the Civil War there was, in essence, a military presence for that part of the country that had attempted to secede. And likewise, you could make similar arguments about Texas. And that when we speak of political culture, it's important to consider, you know, the variation in that political culture, not only by group, but by region, and the variations and experiences of those areas. But if you're sort of seeking a kind of American exceptionalism argument, I think there's certainly some merit to that argument in why we're different. But all nations are different. We all have unique histories. And I think it is the case that there have been instances of military occupation in the United States.
We have another question coming to us over the by way of the web, and this one is from Harlan. And Harlan asks, what measures or descriptors would you recommend for meaningful framing of discourse about democracy? Is participation, voting, enough? What about economic empowerment? How else would you measure or describe democracy? Can I ask Jane?
That's a really good question. It's a hard one. It's a hard one. You know, there are political scientists who try to attempt to measure who's got the better democracy. The best one, the sort of most robust one, and they're typically always indicators that look pretty American, by coincidence, perhaps not. And I think that within the context of the American democracy, I mean, I don't think we want to only measure it with respect to voting or who does it, but we also want to balance off those twin imperatives that are implicit and explicit throughout the founding document. Whether you like it or not, it's the founding document between liberty and equality, that tension that we have between them. We do a lot with liberty. We do a lot less with equality. And so to the extent that we want to expand our meaningful framing about discourse and democracy, we might want to consider trying to better understand the conditions under which equality has been a goal that we have reached, and the extent to which liberty is one that also that we have reached and perhaps paid a little bit more attention to.
And I would just add to that, because one of the interesting things, and again, just sort of thinking about this through the prism of Egypt, is since labor movements were so active and continue to be active even after the official fall of Mubarak, that people kept trying to segregate their demands for, fair wages, and demands that basically everyone kept trying to say these are economic demands. These aren't relevant to what we're moving, how we want to move forward. And the counter, the retort was, no, these are incredibly political demands. And I think that goes. The question is off the screen now. I wanted to reference it, but basically, I think thinking about sort of the way in which economic and political demands can be intertwined, and how to think about structural exclusion, income inequality. Income inequalities that exist. And one of the things, like even when I was starting to write about Egypt, somebody kept telling me, you have to take neoliberalism out. If you have the term neoliberalism in your article, it will not get picked up anywhere but a few venues. And I kept it in. And that's, those are choices that we make. But yeah.
But we're having that discussion right now.
No, we are. And I'm very happy to be.
Look at what's going on in Wisconsin.
Yes, exactly. And that was, obviously before that. But I think it's again, it goes back to this idea that I feel like we're really living, and perhaps because I'm a historian, this rare historical moment, it's an opening. And so we really need to seize that opening. It's a moment in which the discourse is opening up, and we have the power to reshape these tired, tired narratives that we've been living with for a long time.
Thank you to you all for the great questions.
Well, thank you to you.
We thank you all for joining us today. This has been very, very interesting. I thank the panel very much. Everyone was so giving and smart. Very good to see you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.